This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. We all have particular childhood memories that we hold on to more strongly than others. Certain trips, conversations, or even traumas stick with us through to our adult life. They shape the story we tell about who we are and where we came from. But how reliable are these memories, and does it ever come time to let them go? These are some of the questions plaguing siblings Danny and Maeve Conroy, the two central characters in the latest novel from Ann Patchett. As kids, Danny and Maeve's father bought a mansion in the Philadelphia suburbs known as the Dutch House. It's an ornate home, and it was their father's prized possession, and also the very thing that drove their mother away. The Dutch House is Ann Patchett's eighth novel. She's also written three nonfiction books and one children's book, and she's the co-owner of Parnassus Books in Nashville. Ann joins me now. Welcome to the show, Ann Patchett.
Thanks so much for having me.
I finished this book yesterday, and I miss Danny and Maeve already. But for those of our listeners who haven't read the book, tell us a bit more about the family that we're following and the role of the Dutch House in their story.
Sure. And I want to say you did a very good job setting this up. So not everybody does. But Danny and Maeve Conroy live in Elkins Park outside of Philadelphia. Their father, Cyril, in 1950, bought this incredible mansion to surprise his wife. They were in very, very poor people, and he made a lot of money very quickly in real estate. It's kind of important to remember that after the Second World War, there wasn't much of an American middle class, so people were either extremely poor or extremely rich for the most part, and they jumped from one side to the other. The mother did not want to be rich, and she walked away from the house and her family. And it's just about what happens over the next 40 years. Danny and Maeve are thrown out of the house. They become very poor again. They grow up. They have good lives. They're very close. But the problem is they can't let go of the central trauma of their childhood. They're smart, funny people. They have a really good time together, but they just can't get over their past.
Well, you mentioned this question of wealth and who inherits what and who works for what. And I know that watching the 2016 election, you were really curious about the way that you saw Americans place a particular value on wealth. Can you talk a bit more about that thread and how that plays out in the book?
Sure. I think that this has been going on for some time in our country, but I like to say in this Kardashian world in which we live, in which it seems that there is this celebration of wealth and that nothing could be better than being really, really rich. And the person who appears to be the richest is the person who wins. And I just thought, I want to just stake a claim for the idea that not everybody longs to be rich and that money is not the greatest reward. And so there is this one character, Elna, the mother, who is just repulsed, there's no other word, by the family fortune, because she wants to help the poor. She sees herself as a poor person and a friend of poor people, and the wealth is overwhelming. And that really did come to me at the moment of the 2016 election.
I know that you wrote an initial version of this book and then scrapped it and rewrote it. And as part of that was this question around your frame of Elna and understanding who she was and her motivations. Can you tell us about how you had to rework that to get to the version of your book that we're all reading now?
Yeah, it's a little tricky to talk about because I don't want to give too much of the book away. But basically, I thought that Elna was the hero at first for walking away. And then I finished the book, and it was such a disaster. And when I threw it away, and I did just delete all the files, and I started over again, because it wasn't working. It did not ring true, which was weird that I got all the way to the end without realizing how bad it was. But the thing that I figured out is that a woman who leaves her children can never be the hero of the story, basically. And when I sat down and started to think it over again, I thought a lot about the mothers that I know who have small children, and I tried to imagine them leaving their children simply because they wanted to go and serve the poor. And it didn't work. It didn't work when I was thinking about real women with real children. And then, of course, the flip side of that is men do leave all the time to go out and seek their great purpose, either for riches or for noble ideas. And no one has trouble with that. So I was really torn about that.
That's so interesting, because the way that gender is portrayed in this book is something that was really striking for me, because we do see the world through the perspective of Danny, who is the brother, and he is sometimes really oblivious to all of the work that the women around him are doing. What do we learn about the gender dynamics of this family through you telling the story through Danny's point of view?
Well, Danny is smart and affable and funny, and everybody likes him, and he moves so easily through the world, and he moves through the world with great privilege, but oblivious is exactly the right word. He never stops to think that he is being held aloft on the shoulders of all of these women, his sister, his mother, and the household staff from the Dutch house, who all adore him and work for his happiness every moment of every day. And he doesn't know that. He doesn't realize that his life is easy because all of these women are there to make it easy. And the funny thing is, I've actually met men like this in my life.
I was going to ask, is there a Danny in your life?
I think there are like 50 Dannys in my life. You know, people will say to me, how could you possibly write so convincingly from a man's point of view? And it's like, I know this guy. This guy is everywhere. And yet I like him too. And I was really glad to be writing from his perspective, because if you wrote about Danny, you would have to be critical. Danny is not critical of himself. So we as the reader get to see him, even though he's the person telling us the story. We know things about him he doesn't know about himself.
So the depth of the sibling bond between Danny and Maeve is at the core of this book. And I wonder if you could do a reading for us that really gets at how strong this relationship is between Danny and Maeve.
I would be happy to. And this is still pretty close to the beginning of the book. And Danny is speaking. Mothers were the measure of safety, which meant that I was safer than Maeve. After our mother left, Maeve took up the job on my behalf, but no one did the same for her. Of course, Sandy and Jocelyn mothered us. They made sure we were washed and fed, and that our lunches were packed and our scouting dues paid. They loved us. I know they did. But they went home at the end of the day. There was no crawling into bed with Sandy or Jocelyn when I had a bad dream in the middle of the night, and it never once occurred to me to knock on my father's door. I went to Maeve. She taught me the proper way to hold a fork. She attended my basketball games and knew all my friends and oversaw my homework and kissed me every morning before we went our separate ways to school and again at night before we went to bed, regardless of whether or not I wanted to be kissed. She told me repeatedly, relentlessly, that I was kind and smart and fast, and I could be as great a man as I made up my mind to be. She was so good at all of that, despite the fact that no one had done it for her. "Mommy did it for me," she said, surprised that I even brought it up. "Listen, kiddo, I was the lucky one. I got years with her, and you didn't. I can't even think about how much you must miss her."
Author Ann Patchett reading from her new novel, The Dutch House. She'll be at Jubilee Community Church in Asheville on Saturday, October 26th. And she has several other stops around the state on her book tour. You can find all of those details at our website, stateofthings.org. That passage is so beautiful to me because I know so many people in my life who've grown up in blended families where either the mother or the father was absent for some period, and the sibling kind of stands in as that role, and the relationship between the two siblings becomes so primary, almost like a father-daughter or mother-son kind of relationship. What is it about the sibling bond that you're so interested in? Because it really shows up in a lot of your work.
It does. And I've thought about it a lot because, you know, it's not like I sit down and think, I'm going to write another book about siblings. And I've been thinking lately, I write very little about romantic love. I don't know why. And I think that this idea of such a primary relationship from which there are no exits, right? You're not going to divorce your sibling. And even people that I know who can't stand their siblings and haven't spoken to their siblings in years, you're still connected. And at the end of the day, if you get a phone call from jail in the middle of the night, you're going to go, because that's the bond that you can't get away from. And I think that as a novelist, I'm really interested in the inescapable.
As their bond evolves over the course of the book, it gets challenged by these various people that come in and out of their lives. And I'd love to know, kind of, there's grief there for me of kind of realizing that this bond becomes changed when new people enter the picture. How did you come to explore the grief aspect of siblinghood? Is that resonant from your own life?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, it's interesting because in my own life, I have a sister, and then I have many step-siblings that I have various levels of closeness to. In fact, my North Carolina stepsister is the person that I'm so close to. And what I have found over the years for my sister and for my stepsister, we've gotten closer as we've gotten older, and that when we were kids, we really couldn't stand each other at moments and wanted to get away from one another. And I think that as time goes by and other people fall away, we're really tied together. I think that for Danny and Maeve, there is a kind of sadness because Danny doesn't think of Maeve in a very deep or complicated way. And so it's always been about Maeve giving Danny what he wants and needs, anticipating his needs and giving him things before he even knows that he needs them. And then finally, when they're adults, she takes a moment for herself and she says, you know, I'm going to do what's best for me and not what's best for you. And that's very, very hard for them. But it doesn't break them up. Hmm. They still love each other.
Well, this book follows their relationship over multiple decades, and I'm curious, I'm not going to give away the ending, but it does leave the reader with some unanswered questions, some need to kind of fill in more of the timeline on their own. As a writer, how do you choose when to say goodbye to the characters and where to leave the reader with unanswered questions?
It's a great question. I leave the reader at the point at which I think that the reader has enough information to take the story forward for herself. And that, to me, is the difference between literary fiction and commercial fiction. And I love commercial fiction, and it's great, but it does all the work for you, and it answers all the questions. Literary fiction should give you enough information that when you close the book and you're done, those characters live with you because you're responsible for imagining their future.
As a bookseller, how does that shape how you write, or does it at this point, when you see so clearly how readers are interacting with texts and the kind of things that move them, the kind of covers that they pick up and the ones that they don't?
It does a lot in terms of the cover. And I've always been a writer who's very interested in covers and involved in that part of the work. But boy, I know a good cover from a bad cover now that I co-own Parnassus Books. And I'm so excited about the cover of The Dutch House. And I had a lot to do with it because a friend of mine, Noah Satterstrom, painted this portrait of Maeve that's on the cover of the book. And I knew that I didn't want a house on the cover because it's so important to me that the reader imagines the Dutch house. But there in the Dutch house is this portrait of Maeve. So the idea that you're reading along and suddenly you think, oh my gosh, that painting on the cover, that's her. That's the painting that's hanging in the drawing room. I love that.
It's definitely a very captivating image. And I did keep flipping to the front of the book at times to be like, wait, is there a photo of the Dutch house? Like, what does it look like? Because, but I have such a vivid picture in my mind that probably doesn't match what everyone else has in theirs.
Right. Because I think that everyone has had that experience of falling in love with a house. Maybe it's a house you live in, or a house that you drove by once, or a house that you went to a party in, and you just thought, this is the most extraordinary house. And I wanted everyone to be able to call up that house in their mind.
I'd love to turn now to talk a little bit about the creative process. And I know that you and writer Elizabeth Gilbert are good friends. And I read her book, Big Magic, earlier this year, and in which she tells a story about you. And the basic gist is that she started writing a novel set in the Amazon. She set it aside for a while, lost her inspiration, later found out you were writing a novel that was really similar, that turned out to be your bestseller, State of Wonder. And she kind of poses this idea that if we don't engage with our creative ideas, they go on. They look for another vessel to inhabit. Right. What do you make of that assertion? Is that how you think about creativity?
It's not, but it is a true story. And when I met Liz for the first time, which was right after Eat, Pray, Love came out and before it had become Eat, Pray, Love, the international juggernaut, we were on a panel together speaking to a group of librarians, and we just really hit it off, and we had a great night. And at the end of the night, we were saying goodbye and, you know, a hug and a kiss, and I left. And soon thereafter, I started thinking about the idea of my next novel, which turned out to be State of Wonder. And Liz believes that when we kissed that night, when we first met, that the idea that she was letting go of the Amazon novel, because she decided she was going to write another book, came to me. And on one hand, I'm way more practical than Liz, and I think, oh, that's not true. It's a coincidence. But if you look at the what she had already written and what she knew her book was about, and what I wrote and what my book was about, it was the same thing. Like, the character is a woman in her 40s who's a doctor who starts out in Minnesota, and her lover tells her to go down to the Amazon. I mean, it's crazy how similar our ideas were. So I would say that I can't explain that, but Liz can explain it. And I love everything about her. I love her energy, her creativity, and her certainty about how ideas move through the world.
I'm talking with author Anne Patchett about her new novel, The Dutch House, today on The State of Things. What is the Anne Patchett version of how ideas move through the world?
I'm just such a workhorse. You know, to me, I'm 55, and I think when I was 18, when I was 22, I really believed in imagination and creativity and the muse and the ideas, and, you know, that a story could just come to you in the middle of the night. I can remember writing things on the palm of my hand because I would be standing in line at a bank and I would have an idea and I would be so overcome. That is just so long gone. At some point, it becomes a job. You know, if you're a writer, it's one thing if you're a creative person who writes and has ideas, that's one thing. But if you're somebody who puts out a novel every 3 years and does a lot of magazine and newspaper work and goes on book tour and gives talks and writes all the time for a living, this is how I pay for the house and buy dog food and the whole thing, then it's a job. And I look for my ideas and I think very carefully and I work very hard, but I don't really believe that there is some muse that's whispering in my ear.
I only have about a minute or so left, but I would love to end with a question for you about what writers are challenging you the most right now? What writers are you reading whose books you can't wait to get back to?
I am right in the middle of reading Louise Erdrich's new book, which is called The Night Watchman, and it's coming out next March. And this is the problem with owning a bookstore, is everything that I read is coming out in the future. Gish Jen's book, The Resistors, which is coming out in February, is one of the best books I have read in 5 years. For things that have just been published, Margaret Atwood's The Testaments it so exceeds every wild expectation that anyone could have had for that book. Also, I love Colson Whitehead's The Nickel Boys, which came out in July. And North Carolina listeners, Margaret Rankle's book, Late Migrations, is for you. Be sure to find that. It's a beautiful, beautiful book about growing up in the country and nature and the natural world and family. It's so gorgeous.
Incredible. Anne Patchett, with her latest novel, The Dutch House. She's written 7 other novels, 3 works of nonfiction, and 1 children's book. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
You can see her on Saturday, October 26th at the Jubilee Community Church in Asheville, Sunday, October 27th at Meredith College in Raleigh, or Monday, October 28th at Calvary Moravian in Winston-Salem. You can find details for all of those events at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, what does early trauma in baboons tell us about a mother's offspring? We're talking to new MacArthur genius Jenny Tung about her research. Stay with us.